Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Tuesday, the 27th of August. Coming up on the program, how local businesses can be better supported to withstand the online Chinese retail expansion. The two-pot system is just around the corner. What more do you need to know? Tough tax breaks for Olympic medal winners and how non-enforcement of RICA compliance is fueling crime. Well, it's just around the corner, and from the 1st of September, your retirement savings will be split into a vested savings and retirement component. The vested component will be made up of your retirement savings on the 31st of August, and you'll have access to a cash portion, that's a savings component, while preserving the rest for retirement. So a quick recap on where we are and what we need to know. Warren Wilkinson is a financial planner at Consult by Momentum and joins me on the program now. And first of all, Warren, are the necessary funds and systems in place to manage that split from the 1st of September?
Look, as far as we've been made aware from the market, every company has started when they first got news that this was going to land on the 1st of September to make sure from an IT perspective that they are able to accommodate the changes. And we have been led to believe that they are ready. I would probably say that it won't be uncommon for us to pick up a couple of gremlins along the line with some providers. But we have been told by the market at large that they are ready. So, but I think, you know, the open market, I think, needs to be practical around the fact that this is a big move for the financial services providers. And, you know, there may be one or two glitches, but I think the glitches in themselves will probably resolve itself shortly afterwards if there happens to be a gremlin here or there.
Now, what's confusing me a little bit is that we've known this entire thing as the two-pot system, but Warren, you're actually going to tell us there are three pots, a vested pot, a savings pot, and a retirement pot.
Yes, thanks, Jeremy. I think obviously a lot regarding the two pots refers to individuals that have never started to save anything for retirement. And from the 1st of September, they will be the ones that will be exclusively exposed to the new two-pot system. But for the majority of South Africans, and obviously what sketches the background to this whole change for our retirement reform in South Africa, will sit with three pots as part of their retirement provision. The one, which being the vested pot, which would be what they've saved up to the end of August this year. And then the new two pots that will be added from the 1st of September, being the savings pot and the retirement pot.
So the suggestion, I guess, you would give us is that you've got to let that savings pot grow. You can't meddle or tamper with that.
Well, Jeremy, that would be the best advice. You know, I do understand that we're dealing with a scenario where we have many, many consumers under financial constraints, considering the high inflation rate that we experienced since COVID, the fact that cost of living has gone through the roof, the fact that we've got the majority of South Africans under severe pressure financially in terms of the cost on their debt. And obviously, if we look at our unemployment rates in South Africa, there's a clear and obvious need for folk to manage their financial affairs a lot more prudently. The challenge for us is that as much as the savings pot allows you access to your pension fund saving strategy, you should really be discouraged as much as possible from eating into that part of your investment planning, because if you think about it, your retirement is your responsibility. Our environment in South Africa does not allow you to rely on the state. So, you know, if you want to eat cat food or caviar, the choice is yours. And you've got to make sure that your retirement provision exclusively focuses on ensuring that you have a measure of retirement that is going to support your lifestyle one day when we enter into that phase of our life. But as I said, on the other part of the coin, as you alluded, there are a lot of South Africans that are in desperate need for cash. And so they are going to be tempted from putting their hand in that jar, unfortunately.
And then I just want you to reiterate this. It's not the first time that I've covered this, but of course there are tax implications here.
Yes, most certainly. And I think the tax will be always applicable once you pull it out of the veil of a retirement vehicle. In this case, the savings pot will allow you to withdraw absolutely everything in that pot once a year, and it's per product. It's not across the board. So if you've got three retirement annuities with three different providers, you are able to access the full amount in your savings pot subject to your marginal income tax rate, and that's the scary part. So if you're paying 25, 30, 40% income tax, in fact, that withdrawal may push you into another income tax bracket, which you'd have to be mindful of. But in effect, you'll be paying your current marginal tax rate on that withdrawal from your savings pot. And that's what makes it even more damaging for your efforts to save towards retirement, because not only are you eating into your long-term provision for that plan, but you're also paying a lot more tax, which is unnecessary.
So how can individuals then, Warren, ensure that they're making the best use of the vested and the savings components?
Jeremy, I think, you know, working with a certified financial planning professional that is independent and objective as far as ensuring that they can maintain their investment strategies across different elements is quite critical, because I think, as I mentioned and alluded to, every individual, and I mean generally South Africans, are poor savers, just like Americans. So we're not that far different from the American population. We just save very poorly. And in essence, for your emergencies on a year-to-year basis, you need to have a separate investment vehicle and solution for that. So I think linking in with a certified financial planning professional is critical. And then I think you need to have that person in your camp to whom you can refer to for wise counsel and accountability. So that, look, if at the end of the day the pawpaws hit the fan and you need to access cash, and this is the most effective way of doing it without landing into a debt scenario, which can also create challenges and problems, as we've seen, especially as the interest rate hikes, as the interest rate cycle should be coming down in the next sort of 3 to 4 years, you know, you then want to sit with that individual to determine whether accessing the savings pot is going to be the most economical for you at that point in time.
So as a result of that advice, then, what's the best advice you would have for individuals nearing retirement with all of these changes in mind? My sense is just hold steady.
Absolutely. I think there's been a lot of fear in the market for retirees nearing that life phase because they feel like their assets are going to, you know, be going into a space where other individuals other themselves is going to be able to have a say over what happens to that money, and that is not the case. So in terms of the Pension Fund Act, all three pots are fully protected in terms of the Pension Fund Act, so retirees should not be concerned, and I think they should take extra care to ensure that they explore all their options to ensure that they can maintain the income that they require for the whole of their life, bearing in mind that longevity is another risk that we all have to be mindful of. So, you know, the decisions regarding living and life annuities has also been a big debate in our industry in the last number of years, and it is increasingly important, and that challenge doesn't go away, to ensure that you select the appropriate income vehicle to support your standard of living in retirement.
Warren Wilkinson, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Next month, the South African Revenue Service starts imposing import duties on small parcels, but the reality is local retailers are still going to battle to compete with the likes of Shein or Temu. Harold Harvey is Localization Support Fund Chairman and joins me on the program, and we're going to talk specifically about impact and strategy. So first of all, these new arrivals, Harold, how have they changed or upset the local market?
Look, I mean, obviously what you have are two sort of behemoths, if you will, of global digital commerce entering the market. Not in a way unexpectedly. I mean, you know, Amazon had been expected to arrive for a long while, took a bit longer than planned, I suspect. But there have obviously been challenges. There have been loopholes in the way that the customs arrangements worked, which are in the process of being plugged. So, yeah, and they've kind of given consumers access to super, super cheap stuff, right, in some cases. But actually, you know what? I mean, this is at a certain level from the fund's perspective. We don't have, you know, it's not our job to sort out that issue. For us, it's about helping industry make that reality, which is a global reality, our friend, right? And to then figure out, what do we do with that? How do we turn this into an opportunity?
Well, let's talk about that in just a moment, but you will concede that it's becoming increasingly difficult for South African manufacturers to realistically compete with these giants. You know, billion-dollar budgets and government subsidies as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's obviously a huge challenge for local retail and manufacturing, by the way. It's both layers. Mm. But, you know, having said that, there is a reality that adoption of kind of digital retailing by a consumer in South Africa is actually still largely limited. So the vast majority of South Africans, you know, will not really have the ability to interact with those platforms. And on the other hand, we've got some really powerful, you know, home-built platforms, the likes of Takealot and Superbalist and Bash, who have been building muscle and building the infrastructure for last mile logistics, etc. So, you know, it's not all bad news.
So as far as the Localization Support Fund is concerned, are there specific new strategies that you're considering to help your constituency?
Look, I mean, we were founded on the basis that the sort of traditional competitive advantage that the East had relative to South African manufacturing in particular sectors was narrowing, if you will, that gap. The wage differential between South Africa and China, for example, had effectively been eliminated over the last 10 or 15 years. And the issue was that actually there are inherent reasons why South Africa should be competitive as a manufacturing base in a number of value chains. And the gap is actually just about rewiring or replumbing how the value chains work, and then working, teaching people the new muscle, right? Helping them develop the new muscles of how to compete and build their own competitiveness, both for the local market, but also for exports. In this particular case, I mean, what we're really doing is kind of doubling down on the fact that we've got great partners at retail, particularly in the clothing sector, if you take it, and in some other sectors where there are business reasons why shorter supply chains work, right? So why local manufacturing makes sense. How do we then make sure that both on the demand side and the supply side, we are supporting businesses to be competitive? And then the third thing, obviously, is like we've done with some of the other global retailers that have entered the market, is how do we turn that into an advantage? You know, so for example, we've had H&M, to name one. Walmart was an early version of this. Global retailers entering the South African market and saying, hang on, there is actually a source of advantage if we use local manufacturers, and if we're willing to make the commitments to buy local, can that be turned into an incentive for local manufacturers to invest in expanding capacity and improving their investment? And that's what we exist to support, is how do we turn those commitments and those partnerships into very practical support in a factory of how do you get more efficient, how do you free up capacity for growth, how do you reduce unit cost and give South African manufacturers a fighting chance?
I understand that price as far as consumers is the most important play, but the other issue that you've just raised about convincing people to buy local, are they always going to be driven by price, or is there another more compelling argument perhaps?
Look, I think the fallacy here is, look, I think, you know, there are lots of consumers who do care about, you know, whether the materials being used in a product are sustainable. So there's lots of kind of considerations that are becoming increasingly important, particularly with the younger generations. But I think at the heart of it, what we've got to stop seeing is that somehow there's this automatic trade-off between local industrialization, if you will, and price. One of the reasons that you'll see retailers like the, you know, that we have in South Africa, so the TFG or Mr. Price, etc., punting local manufacturing is because it actually helps them be more competitive. You know, if you order from China and from the East, you have to order, you know, 18 months in advance of a season, you've got to guess what trends are going to look like. You're buying in huge quantities in order to obtain the price advantage. All of that amounts into massive amounts of working capital that are tied up in very long supply chains, highly predictable. Whereas if you're manufacturing down the road, you can have much shorter order lead times. You can, the working capital that gets freed up means that suddenly manufacturing local gives you a cost advantage. And that's what we focus on as the LSF, is how do we make, where it makes sense in the commodities or in the categories, where it makes sense is how do we help build the competitiveness of local suppliers so that they can support the retailers in competing at value and at price against imports.
And then the new import duties on small parcels, to what extent is that going to assist local retailers and manufacturers in the short term?
Obviously, the plan is that what it does is it eliminates the potential of the small parcel model that the likes of Temu are using, right? Which you sort of, in a sense, was the loophole that they were using. So in theory, the value of a T-shirt coming in from China through on a small parcel versus as part of a big order in a container should now be the same. It all comes down to the capabilities of customs at the borders to enforce the rules. I mean, let's not, you know, run away from the fact that historically, I mean, if you look at some of the prices that some of these platforms are selling stuff at, that's below the cost of production. There's no, there's clearly under invoicing happening. We've, you know, under Commissioner Kiesewetter, there's been huge investment in upping the capability of the Customs Service to enforce the law as it exists, with huge improvements. And so it's going to come down to that partnership. I know that through the master plan process, that the private sector has deployed capabilities to support SARS in being able to understand, you know, that this suit that is now being imported is actually not made of wool, it's made of something else, or that the list of prices of this thing is impossible to have achieved, that must be fraudulent. And so, you know, that will be a journey, but the proof of the pudding will be in the eating.
All right, Harold Harvey, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Weak RICA compliance and unsecured SIM card packaging are fueling organized crime. And so, is there a way around this? Is there a new approach or a new strategy that can be adopted? Because it really is a serious problem. I'm going to talk now to Sipeleli Kanyile, who is General Manager of Securitech SA, and he hopefully has some answers as far as this is concerned. And firstly, let's start with this. How significant is the role of weak RICA compliance in the rise of organized crime in South Africa?
Look, it's fairly significant. You would have seen it in the news, especially lately. There was a case with Senzi Mewa's hit, where the guys could have been found quickly if the SIMs they were using were registered in their names. As you saw in my article, there was a syndicate that was caught in Sandton as well, where people were cloning these SIM cards in bulk. So it's a material thing where criminals, noting the gap in the enforcement of RICA, can proudly advertise their numbers because they know that they're not linked to them anyway. In addition to that, they have the ability to create a fake paper trail as far as their criminal activities, because the authorities would be chasing one number, thinking it belongs to the criminal, whereas it legitimately belongs to somebody else because it was recorded in somebody else's name. So it's So it is a serious problem that is overlooked, mostly because of a lack of understanding of the technology to a certain degree. You can see in the way that Rika has been implemented as opposed to Fika, for example, that with banks, you won't be able to open a bank account at all if they're not compliant. But Rika, there's more of a relaxed stance as far as
right
enforcement of the rules. Yeah.
So you talk about that gap in enforcement. Where then are current regulations around SIM card registration and Rika compliance not adequate?
Well, so there's a few things. So for starters, especially lately, you find that you can go into a shop and buy a pre-Rika SIM. When Rika was originally documented on paper, it was amazing because we had a way to actually register the cell phone number to a person as well as their residential address, and from there, the authorities would be able to get the location or know exactly who was using a particular SIM card. So what we're finding lately is that some shops and some distributors have a means to pre-Rika the SIM, and B, we've seen instances where the SIM cards are being distributed unpackaged, meaning that the numbers that identify the SIM cards for what they are can be read without the person even needing to open a package, let alone repackage it afterwards. So these are the challenges that the authorities would be faced with if they were to ever fully utilize the records that have been basically put together, or rather saved, as part of the registration process.
Are there better ways that the telcos as a unit can push back more effectively?
Oh, definitely. Well, see, one of the challenges we have with regards to Rika in particular is that it's not centrally implemented, meaning that there's different telco providers in South Africa, and there's no central rules that govern how starter packs or SIM cards are to be packaged to ensure that the Rika compliance is enforced as well. So ultimately, the low-hanging fruit here would be to make sure that the SIM cards are packaged in a secure pack that is tamper-evident as well, so that as you're buying a SIM card at the shop, you will know if somebody has touched it. Imagine if you were to fetch your bank card at the bank and the envelope that it comes in has already been opened. That would be unheard of, and you'd be up in arms, and rightly so. So what people haven't realized is that SIM cards, as they stand at the moment, are more important or more risky than your bank card. Your SIM card and your cell phone is your wallet. It's your way to receive your OTP. So from that perspective, it needs to receive the same level of security. And we're seeing that Rika, as it is, it works in certain regions. Like, I don't know if you would have noticed that in Nigeria, for example, they've re-emphasized the security, or rather the Rika process, as a result of exactly the upswing of crime as we're talking about right now. So we're seeing that in other jurisdictions, this does work. As long as it's implemented correctly, so that impetus to actually do it properly is still severely lacking in South Africa, because people are not drawing this parallel between the lack of security and the crime rate.
And part of the problem is that there is a lack of real public awareness here.
Definitely, people have not connected the dots, and it's my hope that this conversation is going to draw attention to something that has been severely lacking, especially lately.
You mentioned Nigeria. Are there other international best practices that this country could adopt to ensure that kind of compliance, that better or more secure compliance that you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. So we're seeing that Indonesia, for example, and the UAE, they've adopted it in a way that it has not been disruptive. Whereas in Nigeria, it was disruptive, but for good reason. And when the dust settled, everybody was better for it. But Indonesia and the UAE have done it seamlessly. Even as a tourist, when you arrive, they know who the SIM went to. And when you leave, that SIM card stops working. So these are things that can be done at very little cost to either the consumer or the telcos.
What I find astonishing is that the solutions that you're putting forward seem to be fairly straightforward, yet they're not happening.
As I said, no attention has been drawn to this. No attention has been drawn to this. And the frog has been cooked very gradually as well. So what we're seeing is that the rules are being relaxed gradually, since there's no pushback and since there's no apparent link between people getting away with murder and Rika. Mm.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. And thanks for shining some light on a very important issue. Sipeleli Kanyile, General Manager, Securitech SA. Appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
For South African Olympians and soon-to-be Paralympians, the journey to success involves more than just winning gold, silver or bronze. It also comes with complex tax considerations. The cash incentives are a sweet reward, but come with a taxing twist. As these athletes celebrate their achievements, is it beneficial for them and their tax advisors to better understand the tax regulations to ensure that those hard-earned rewards are as sweet as possible? I'm going to talk now to Jane Ndlovu, taxation specialist and senior lecturer at the Margot Steele School of Accountancy at the University of the Witwatersrand. And firstly then, how did South African tax laws treat the cash incentives that our athletes have received for winning the medals and have brought home?
So most athletes at the Olympics and the Paralympics are professionals or semi-professionals, which means their goal is to win, and that comes with tax obligations. Whether these athletes receive cash prizes like the cash incentives from SASCOC or in-kind rewards like medals, all of it counts as taxable income. In South Africa, this income is taxed because it's earned through the athlete's trade, essentially their profession. This principle was established in a key legal case in 1992, the Commission of Inland Revenue versus Pick and Pay Employee Share Purchase Trust, which states that determined income is taxable when it is earned by design and not by chance. This means if the receipt of income bears the imprint of revenue and is not fortuitous, but designedly sought for and worked for, then it is taxable.
Jane, does it make any difference this year, particularly when our athletes received prize money in France?
Yes, it does. So when you compete abroad, things can get complicated. France, for example, imposes a 15% withholding tax on non-resident athletes' earnings. This could lead to double taxation if the income is also taxed back in South Africa. But there are ways that to manage this, like using tax treaties to avoid paying tax twice on the same earnings.
So explain to me what a tax treaty is.
Okay. So a tax treaty is when one country enters into agreement with another country and they decide who has the taxing right. So with the South African and French tax treaty of 1993, though France will impose a 15% withholding tax, South Africa does allow the athletes to claim a credit against their taxes, and this prevents them paying double tax.
So, Jane, it would be critical then for athletes, in spite of all the work they've got to do, either on the track or in the pool or wherever the case is, to also engage in some very serious early tax planning, particularly if they are successful enough or believe they are successful enough to bring home a medal.
Yes, I definitely agree. My advice to them would be to be proactive and informed. They need to work closely with a knowledgeable tax advisor who understands the unique challenges of international sports income. By planning ahead, keeping detailed records, and staying up to date with their tax obligations, they can avoid penalties and make the most of their earnings.
What about deductions?
So athletes can deduct a range of expenses, but it depends on whether they are competing as independent professionals or part of a sports club. For independent athletes, deductible expenses can include things like training costs, travel, equipment, and even sports membership fees. However, if the expenses exceed their income, they might run into the suspect trade rules, which require them to carry forward any losses to the next year, meaning they can't offset these losses against other income.
Are you able to provide an example of how improper tax reporting can lead to severe penalties?
Yes. So there was a news article about international sports stars like Lionel Messi, who was reported to have faced serious consequences for not managing his tax affairs correctly. It was related to brand endorsements. And there was even a story about Roger Federer choosing to train in Germany instead of the UK to manage his tax liabilities.
So finally then, is there any specific advice, Jane, that you would give to athletes and their advisors to ensure constant compliance, not only with South African tax regulation, but also the international laws?
Yes. So they need to get tax advice from someone who understands how not only their prize money, but every aspect of their income, whether it's income that they earn from endorsement deals, so that they can make informed decisions and keep their financial situation as strong as their athletic performance.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Jane and Vlovo, thank you very much indeed from Wits University. I appreciate your time tonight. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.